Welcome into the hours. We got another episode where we're going to share the stuff that we think good coaches should know. We are Savvy Coaching. I am Mark, joined by my good friend, Tyler. Tyler, good morning.
Cheers. Coming to you outdoors today. I'm enjoying some fresh air. One thing that stuck with me forever is I had a mentor once said, bolt for sunlight. When you first wake up in the morning, get outside as early as you can. It builds up your rhythm. A little vitamin D wakes you up, gets you in touch with nature. So I bolted for sunlight this morning and have not bolted back. And, you know, because we're racing space, we bolt everywhere at all times. So, yeah, I think maybe that's where bolting came from.
Yeah, get that circadian rhythm right, and bonus points if you do it barefoot. Get some grounding in.
I am barefoot.
There you go.
I love it.
That's a great morning.
I know. Now I just need to do some stretching, some yoga. Finish with a nice bowl of granola, and I'll have made a lot of friends in the natural community.
Gratitude journal too.
There it is. We could go for a while, I think, and do some Wim Hof breathing probably. Finish with the cold plunge.
Love it.
All right, small question for you before the big question. And it may not be that small. I did a thing last night where I told a story to current players about an exemplary past player and all the amazing attributes that they had. I think every coach does this at certain points. Small question for you. Do you think it's helpful to extol the attributes and qualities of past special players to current players?
I think as a coach, it might make you feel better, or think it's a good way to inspire your players. Honestly, flipping it, and I've never thought of it this way, but the current players might not care. But I do think it's important that they know impactful players in the program of the past and try to connect your present to your alumni or your players that have graduated. So I do think that's important. If you do that, I would encourage you to go a step further. I actually give you something that we did, which would be cool, is every player write a letter to the player that will wear their number next. And just, yeah, how they wanted to represent the number, leave the number better than you found it. So if you find yourself referencing players from the past, just maybe make an effort to connect it to your current team.
Yeah, I think that's good. All right, a couple of quick thoughts around this. I've gotten feedback from players feeling like it put them down. It's like saying, oh, you know, we're not as good as these players you had in the past. You're not proud of us. You wish that you had this player back. You think they're better than me. And I think that can be communicated just in the tone. Like if you're comparing, like, oh, I had this team that really worked hard and you guys are lazy. Okay, that then it could come across as that. But on the flip side of it, I also think that it's really helpful to share an example of what the gold standard of this would be, right? Oh, you want to be a college basketball player. Well, the gold standard of communication was this player, and here's specifically what they did. So try to do more of that. I think there's value in that. And then I think that if a coach is going to do that, I think it's really a great way to stay connected to your players is to reach back out to that player and be like, hey, I was thinking about you today. I talked about you in practice. And that can be so uplifting. I had that happen years after I was done playing in college. My high school coach reached out to me and said that he established a leadership award, and he called it the Tyler Costin Leadership Award. He's like, so every year I give out the Tyler Costin Leadership Award because of the leader that you were. And I tell the stories about you, and it meant so much to me. I don't know if it meant anything to these kids. They didn't know who I was, but it meant so much to me that I think there's value in that, because when you coach a team or coach a player, I don't think you stop being that player's coach once they graduate or move on. Those experiences were the most memorable, most impactful ones of that time of my life. And I think that I would just remind all of us as coaches that, you know, outside of someone's parents, you as a coach are going to be the most influential and impactful voice for good or for ill in this young person's life. And so continue to treat that as, you know, a high responsibility and zoom out. Over the course of life, I can't remember a single social event from high school, you know, a date, a party, you know, hang out, whatever. I can't remember the details of any of it, but I can remember so many moments in practice where I was coached or encouraged. I can remember so many moments, you know, in games where I was coached or encouraged. And so, I mean, it was just the most formative stuff. And I think we as coaches need to remember that.
Yeah, that actually happened to me recently. Is one, you know, you talk about the relationship. They'll always call you coach. You'll always be their coach, which is really cool. But as I was preparing for our Drive in Space cohort, I was going through some film, and a certain player just kept popping up in these clips. And I'm like, gosh, this dude was a baller. So just sent him a text and was like, hey, man, I'm watching some old film. Just wanted to remind you how much of a baller you were in high school. And his, you know, so then that just generated a conversation between us. And all he kept talking about was, I miss the time spent together, you know, bus rides, locker room. It had nothing to do with, oh yeah, I remember when I scored 20 points that game, or it was just all the time spent together and how much we miss that.
Yeah, that's good. It's good to keep that in perspective when we're really stressing over a win or a loss. But that's not what you guys bonded over. It was all the moments, right? Okay, big question. Why do you choose to teach Drive in Space the way that you do and prioritize what you teach instead of Race in Space?
This has come up a lot. And I would say, I don't know if I would even say instead of Race in Space, because so much is the same and borrowed and the same concepts. I tell people all the time, I think the end product looks very, very similar. I think our paths to get there is a little different though, but I think we arrive at the same place. I think the way I teach Drive in Space derives from, one, my early experiences being brought up in a motion system. It gave me a ton of perspective on conceptual offense. Everybody got a touch, right? We're all filling different spots. We're all going to handle the ball. We all, you know, I feel the fun part of motion offense is everybody feels connected, right? Because we all have similar responsibilities and do a lot of the same stuff. My evolution as a coach was, okay, I love the ball movement. I love the player movement. I love the connection piece where we have just a shared cognition and we're running this thing together as a group, but we got to be able to create more space. We got to be able to give our players more freedom. How do we do that? And years of sitting on a whiteboard trying to figure out how to blend these two things, I said, you know what? I'm just going to run dribble drive motion, like Vance Wahlberg's version of this. And I did that, and everything I loved about motion went away in a lot of ways. We didn't have as much ball movement. We didn't have as much player movement. Players felt more isolated, I felt, from their teammates. So like the player with the ball, it's their turn. Everybody else, just what do I do? So again, just going on the whiteboard and how do we blend this? How do we blend this? And Drive in Space became the answer. How do we get a lot of ball movement? How do we get a lot of player movement, but give players the freedom to make plays for themselves or their teammates? And I think our freedom comes from choice. We afford them options, and it doesn't matter what you choose. It's going to be some type of coordinated, free-flowing movement that we practice. So what happens in a possession, I don't really know what's coming, but I know it's something that we practice, and I know the other four players on the floor are going to be able to play off of each other. So it gives us the shared cognition. It gives us the freedom. It gives us the space. It gives us the ball movement. So that was kind of my evolution of how we form Drive in Space and how we continue to modify it and tweak it as the game changes. And then as I grow as a coach and my philosophy changes.
Yeah. The words that you used to describe it, there's a lot of overlap. And I do think that there are key differences, and the differences aren't in the outcomes of what a coach might see. I think the key differences, like you said, are in the path to get there, and maybe even the prioritization of the development of the system. And I think that a coach should just choose the approach that they align with most. And so the three words, and I'll ask you after this to share the three words that are the highest priority for a Drive in Space coach, if they really just wanted to follow in your footsteps. So these are the three words that are of the highest priority to me in Race in Space. They were the highest priority in why I developed it, how I developed it, and our pathway and approach to get there. And here's what it is: fun, development, and freedom. Number one, race and space is for those coaches and players that really want to have fun playing the game of basketball. Second, I developed it to develop players. It's a player development system. More touches, really, really clear principles that we're trying to achieve. And then lastly, freedom. Is probably the most free offensive system that I've encountered in my nearly 20 years of coaching. And that's freedom for players and freedom for coaches. I think any coach can run race and space and implement whatever actions that they want, shape that they want, anything like that. So I think those are the three biggest things.
Very similar. We talk about playing decisive, fast, and free. And decisive is our freedom from choice. And I think you said something very, you talk about freedom. Ours comes from, you can do A or B, whatever one you like better, whatever suits your game better, whatever comes more natural to you. It doesn't matter which one you choose. Just do it. Be really decisive. Let's play fast. Let's move the ball quick. Let's play off the catch. 0.5. We all know that. And then, you said freedom. We say free. I even think free goes with fun as well. My biggest drawback when I was a motion coach, I felt like players felt a little handcuffed. And here was my revelation, and maybe you could push back on this, whether you're, if you disagree, maybe you agree. Motion affords a lot of freedom, but without the ball. So if I pass, I can cut or screen. If I'm getting a screen, I could curl or flare. And a lot of that is reading the defense and reacting to the defense. We want to be the actor. We are all, you're going to react to us. Action is always faster than reaction. So drive in space, when we're decisive, we remain the actor. And we have freedom with the ball instead of without the ball. And I feel like that's what makes players feel unleashed to make those plays for themselves or their teammates, where like when you have the ball, you are thinking about, actually, let's rewind to balls in the air. You're thinking my feet, my catch, my vision, my shot, my drive. And if none of that works out, then you share it. And that sounds really, really selfish, but the decisive, fast, and free part is we have five players on the floor that are in constant attack mode. And to me, that's a better offense than we're going to back screen here and then down screen there. And we're going to read the defense and we're going to be in triple threat. I just want five players that feel unleashed to make plays, selfish in pursuit of your own skill, unselfish when it comes time to blend that within team concepts.
Yeah. So, obviously, everyone should run race in space. Is basically what I'm hearing.
Did you say drive in space?
Yeah, I think I did. It's just so similar. In fact, if you want to share with everybody what you heard at the clinic, what I think you said the Illinois coach calls their offense.
Yeah.
What,
so
what does he call it?
Race, pace, and space. Coach Underwood, Brad Underwood, spoke right before me. I presented to the Illinois Basketball Coaches Association this past weekend, and it was really cool because I thought of him as more of a defensive coach, like really hard nosed, like we're going to get in you, we're going to be in the ball line and pressure, and defense is going to win, and that's who he was. And a lot of times you hear, sometimes the Power Five coaches, it's more story driven. It's more their experience at that level. And Coach Underwood was really refreshing. He talked about, we don't run any sets anymore. We just create advantages and we want to play out of advantage. We need to shoot more threes. He said 38% of their shots were threes this past season. And that's not nearly enough. So they're going to generate more threes. And everything he was saying, so talking about playing with pace, he said they are getting the ball across half court in 2.7 seconds right now, which is awesome. So he talked about, hey, like, we're gonna make transition defense sprint and coaches are gonna have to spend time stopping our break, and we're gonna flow in the half court. And if we can just flow into the half court and get our point guard, he called it booty ball, and like a post up, he's like, is this good offense? If I can get my point guard right here with the ball. And I'm thinking like, yeah, like you have your point guard like right in front of the rim. And I felt like a lot of coaches were very hesitant to say yes because they didn't run anything, but he's like, this is great offense. So everything that we teach, whether it's driving space, racing space, I mean, he's talking about race, pace, and space. It was, yeah, it was really cool to hear him speak.
Yeah, it's cool to hear more and more successful coaches that have gotten high-paying and high-profile jobs. That's how we'll define it. More and more successful coaches moving towards the concepts that we at Savvy are teaching. And, I mean, there is a shift. There's a movement there. I think we've even seen that in the growth of our coaching community. So thank you to all of you that are listening, that have joined our free coaching community, that are really embracing what we call modern basketball, which is shifting towards this this teaching players how to play instead of teaching them plays on offense, and a willingness to change as a coach. That's what we're teaching is modern basketball. And so we're seeing it more and more at the highest levels. So welcome to the movement. That's what we teach here at Savvy. We think that's smart. We think that's clever. And then we think that's Savvy. All right, should we shift into some mailbag?
Yeah, let's do it. Every week in our community, we open up a mailbag thread where coaches can just drop a question in, and this is where we answer these questions from. Do you prefer to sub based on feel, or do you try to create a set rotation based on position or role? And why do you prefer one over the other?
As always, I think the answer is it depends, but I think you got to have your priorities. So it's probably not all one or all the other, but know like where you're starting from and then what you utilize to shift. I think that's what I mean by prioritize. So I prefer and would suggest that you establish your intended rotation before the game starts. Like, this is who I intend to start. Here's the first round of subs. This is the general minute breakdown. That's my intention. And then there's factors that occur during the game that might shift you off of that. Foul trouble might shift you off of that. Matchups might shift you off of that. If a player is mentally prepared or like performing up to the expectations or above the expectations in the given game, might shift you off of that. But I think the less decisions, we talk about freedom from decisions for players. I think freedom from decisions for coaches is also really, really valuable. And so the less decisions you're trying to make in the moment of, is it time to put so-and-so in, that's going to take away mental capacity, it's going to allow you to be more present and make more strategic adjustments and communicate with clarity to your team and not be thinking about, is it time to put, Sam in?
Yeah, agree. I think with anything, there's a blend of let's be prepared and let's have an idea of going in what our rotation might look like, especially first quarter. Like, who do we want to get in the first quarter, first half? Usually when that happens, goes away once the game starts. Like you said, foul trouble, behavior, performance. So I would encourage any coach thinking about playing time, let's be proactive. Let's communicate with our team. And what I would communicate is the four categories of playing time is one, rotation. Two, it's based on performance. Three, behavior. And four, situational. First bucket, rotation, maybe that's your top eight. Those players you could probably account for. And, our top eight, they're all going to get a good amount of playing time. Our best players are going to play the most minutes, obviously. But we have a good feel for when they're going to go into the game and who for based on their role. Performance is another one. Wow, we put in our sixth man and they are playing extremely well. They're shooting the ball really well, or whatever they do, they're doing it well. Well, maybe their minutes go up, or on the other side of that is this player is not having their best night. They probably are going to play less minutes this game. And then behavior. If somebody is below standard, we should take that player out and not put them back in until they get to standard. And we had a system for that. I would encourage every coach to have a system for that and hold to that. And then last is situational. Whether we have a big team that we're playing against and we need more rebounders or more physical players, our smaller team, we need faster players, or, your 30-30-30 club, up 30, down 30, 30 seconds left. Those might be situations where we play. I think the one you can plan for is your rotational minutes. Outside of that, that's where you got to play off feel.
Yeah. And I would push back on performance as much as I could. Meaning someone's having a really, really good night, or someone's having a really, really bad night. I actually think that we put too much weight on recency bias and the last play as opposed to the law of large numbers, players are always going to revert to the mean. So, oh, someone's having a great shooting night. It's our seventh man, and they knock down their last two threes. We have to give them a bunch more playing time. Well, the most likely result of giving them a bunch more playing time is they're going to miss their next two threes. That's the most likely result. Players are generally going to do what players are going to do, and it's really just randomness. Here's another example of performance perception. You put in your eighth player, and they make two layups. And you're like, oh, we got to keep them going. They made two layups. Anyone in that position would have made those two wide open layups. It's not like they made a great move. It's just you broke the press and you had a run out. Anyone in that role. So is it actually their performance, or is it just they were in at that time when the game created that thing, right? So I think we should really, really question like, oh, they're hot, or oh, they're playing really, really well. I think most performance things that we're perceiving as in-game performance cues are actually standard things. So trend away from performance and more towards standards. If they are really above standard as far as effort, communication, focus, that is going to have a greater impact on performance than performance. And if we can look towards those things above or below standard, right, attitude, you know, frustration, whatever, I think those things is where we should really try to trend in-game adjustments. Standard, not performance. Hey, coaches, my girls' varsity team wants to play 2-3 zone this year. We did some normal, that means not lock left, 2-3 zone, man-to-man with 2-3 zone mixed in with a focus on skill development this summer. We're putting in lock left man as our main defense, but my coaching staff and I believe they will buy in more if our secondary defense is a 2-3 zone. I'm thinking we would keep certain layers of lock left, but put in a 2-3 zone. They ask a couple of questions. Have you ever given a team some player choice that will help them buy in? Has anyone ever done lock left 2-3? And do we also do the other layers of lock left in a 2-3 zone? Any thoughts on this will be appreciated. Let me ask you first, feel free to articulate the answer you put in the community or go off a little bit more.
I don't remember answering this from the community. Do you have it in front of you?
I do. So you said you'll weigh in on a small part. Have you ever given a team some player choice? You said you would include players in as many decisions as possible. Some things will remain and should remain coach-led, but we want to move towards a player-led program. That was kind of your general answer.
Yeah. Okay. So I do remember this now.
Okay.
I would not ask them what defense we should run. That to me is the coach-led part. But I think the question I was answering is, do you ever include players in decision-making to increase buy-in? Mine would be absolutely. It should be a shared culture. I'm not going to ask them what defense we should install because as the head coach, that is your vision to cast. You are thinking in terms of your principles of play and your style and your identity. So I would not ask them if they want to play 2-3. So I'll just start there and piggyback it back to you.
Okay, shoot. I thought I could say the other thing. I would agree with you. Okay, Mark, in your opinion, why would most varsity girls teams have a desire to play 2-3 instead of man?
Because most the 3-point shot is not as big in the girls game as the men's game.
Okay, cool. I think that's probably why most coaches would, in my opinion, would want to do that. I don't think many high school players are thinking strategically like that. And so
okay,
I'm sorry.
I thought you asked from a coach's perspective.
Okay,
so you
cool.
asked
okay,
it from
players. So so this coach is saying that his players really want to play more 2-3 and less man. Why do you think most high school girls would want that?
I would say because it's easier, or they grew up playing it and they're more comfortable with it.
Exactly. And I agreed. So if I was the head coach, I would really ask them why. Why do you want to play 2-3? And in my experience, having worked with many teams, which is pretty unique. Mark and I have gotten to work with many teams, not just our teams, year over year in one area of the country, across the world. Players that really want to play more 2-3 zone are really just lazy. and I'm gonna say it strong. It's just laziness. And so the reason that these players want to play 2-3 is what I would question. Now maybe this team, I don't coach that team. Maybe they're the exception to the rule, and they're really evaluating strategically, and they're playing a high effort 2-3. But I doubt it. I really think it's just laziness. And so I would absolutely push back against that as a coach and say, no, the reason that I've chosen for us to go man is because we need to develop habits of accountability. We have to be better on the ball, and we have to get way more in shape, and we have to give way more effort on defense with way more communication. And going man is what's going to allow us to develop those habits. 2-3 zone won't. And I would not compromise on that if that's the approach, which I assume that it is. So it's almost like when being so player led can go wrong, when you don't hold the standard.
Yeah, which is why, in my opinion, zone defense should not be played at the lowest levels. Right, get them to play hard, embrace man, and then if strategically you can't, you do run zone, it'll be that much better.
It'll be that much better. And if you are putting in lock left, just for the lock lefters here, always put it in man first. It would be my suggestion. Always, even if you intend for your final outcome to be a zone, always put it in man first, because it does have one job, zero excuses. It teaches all of the rotations. And the lock left, more than most defenses, I won't say any, more than most defenses as a man, teaches more zone principles than most man-to-man defenses. It's way heavier on the help, on zoning up, on hunting passes, on guarding two on the backside, overloading the wall. It's the most zone-principled man defense that I've ever taught as well. So that would be my suggestion to you. And then, you know, some of your more specific questions as far as like, how do you do it as a zone? I'll answer in the community. But most of your questions will be answered how you do it as a zone once you establish good man habits out of the lock left.
So two things. One, if you want some feedback, you can obviously join our community. You drop the create a thread or drop this question in the mailbag. We'll go a little bit deeper on the hours into these. But if you want to go even deeper and continue your journey, then I would encourage you to join Grow. You could ask these questions live to Tyler about lock left, where he can show you game film, walk you through diagrams, and those happen on our weekly cohort calls. This month, we're on Drive and Space. Lucky for everyone else, Tyler is going to present on lock left next month. So if you want to go deeper in lock left, I would encourage you to jump in Grow and hop on live with Tyler next month in October. But Tyler.
Well, let me hammer that even harder. If you are considering running lock left this season, I would say you must join our Grow cohort next month. It will give you your best chance of your best lock left season, whether it's your first season or your 10th season doing it. I'm excited to go deep with you. And all of these, every question is better with film. You know, we only do film breakdowns for our Grow members. Any of our Grow members that are going through the lock left cohort, we can send in film for breakdown from me. And we're going to be very film heavy on our weekly consulting calls in lock left. I'm going to Michigan to the Michigan Coaches Association in 2 weeks to present on lock left twice. This is lock left month, people. And if you're not running lock left, I honestly don't know what you're doing. I cannot be convinced that there is a better defense to implement across the board at any level. So convince me. Mark, actually convince me. Tell me why any other defense would be better than lock left to run. What's the reason?
I will say, okay, because this is a question I get a lot. This is good. I was a no middle pressure man to man coach my last head coaching stop. And I think it goes back to something we might have talked about on the hours recently is we can be on board with anything that is principle based, more of how you do what you do rather than just what you do. But we believe in what lock left does. And the only pushback that I could see is the ball goes to the middle of the floor. As a no middle coach, that's a big change. On one side of the floor, we are locking left, right? When the ball is on that side of the floor. But I'll say this, where my lens has really changed, as one, I've gotten to know lock left more. It's so similar. It is the same conversation is race and space and drive and space. Is a lot of it accomplishes the same thing. But when I play basketball, I lock everybody left when they have the ball. And I find myself wanting my teammates to lock the ball left because no one, very, very rarely do you have players that are as good going to their weak hand as they are their strong hand. So why would we not embrace that and use that to our advantage? And I was listening to a podcast with a college coach, and he runs lock left. And I believe this was a Division I program. And he even said, you know, as I watched our practice, I found that very few, if any, of our guys were effective off the ball screen going left. So I just started to say, hey, we're going to force everybody else to their left. And it's been really, really good for them. So I'll have to find that podcast and send it to you, Tyler. You probably enjoy it.
Nice.
Yeah.
So basically you didn't convince me.
I did. Very poor job of convincing me.
We did an hour yesterday, speaking of ball screens. We did an hour of practice yesterday, just guarding ball screens, locking left from every area on the floor. And the reason I did it at first is because we had to get better at it defensively. But the outcome of it was our offensive players got so much better being as ball handling with their left hand, having vision, having patience, and attacking space with their left hand, which we can apply towards any offensive situation, you know, which, you know, for full circle is, I think that's why you should lock left at the lowest levels on yourselves in practice every single day, because it just develops better ball handlers with both sides. And I'll just do this real quick. This is one lock left defensive possession. They got their wolf picking up the ball, just trying to get to the left-hand side. So when we do force left, we're not forcing middle, but it's probably going to happen, right? On the ball, everything's going left anywhere on the floor. This is what we call sitting. You'll see that he's sitting on the right hand on the ball, trying to make the ball go. You know, another thing that I love about lock left is we want more players inside the three-point line, more offensive players inside the three-point line. Here again, wolf on the ball. It's and you can choose to turn up the pressure, but this is just influencing, right? Now the ball's on the left-hand side of the floor. So this would look like a no middle defense. And if your wolf does their job, then when you're locking left, you are forcing no middle. 10 sitting, beautiful. This looks really good right now. Just forcing left-hand dribbles every single time. So just for those of you that might be checking out the podcast for the first time, I don't want to spend a lot of time. I won't do any film breakdown on it, but I just wanted you to see, like, okay, this is what lock left can look like. All right, Mark, any other follow-ups on the lock left? Or another question?
I have a question. Actually, I said I would go to the mailbag. Let's do this one. Before, though, let me ask a follow-up question. We did it, I think you said, like an hour of forcing ball screens to the left. How did you do it? What does that practice look like?
Perfect. We actually started with, all right, game of the week. So our game of the week is attack training. And we attempt to begin every practice like we would warm up for a game. You do this before a game, you do this at the beginning of the practice. So attack training is one of our drills that we do pregame. And attack training is how we train attacking a domino. And so we attack from the action spots in attack training. It's actually a really, really simple setup. And while I'm pulling this up on attack training, Mark, let me ask you this. What do you do for pregame?
Pregame, we use something very similar to attack training. So I wanted my guys to have something competitive, and I wanted to create some reads, decisions. I'll talk two-line layups. We didn't do this, but if you're a coach that likes two-line layups or your players are begging for it, here's a way I would do it. All right, players, you want to do two-line layups? What does a great two-line layup look like? And that way we at least create a standard around it, although I'm not a fan. But my objectives were create some reads, decisions, get as many shots up as possible, and can we incorporate the game plan into pregame warm-up? So here's how we did that. We would play two-on-one dominoes in three groups around the perimeter. So we're getting a lot of shots up, but we're also trying to find the seven, where it's not just mindless shooting. Although I think there is some playing on the road, you might just need to get in the gym, get some shots up. Then we went 4-on-2 Gulf Coast, which is going to create rim reads and perimeter reads for us. It's also starting to train our close-offs and our help, which are so important no matter what defensive system you're running. And then we would play an offensive style game where if we felt like we were going to see really good on-ball defenders, we're going to have to use a lot of protection plans. We would say, all right, in this offensive segment, we want to see a lot of protection plans, or we're going to attack this team with fans. So when we're in Rose series, I want to see way more fan than fingers. That way I know that pregame, my players are mentally preparing for the game we're about to play rather than doing something that has no connection.
Beautiful. Agreed. And the three things that we do pregame are the same things that we do pre-practice, almost identical. Attack training, dominoes, which is 4v2 Gulf Coast, just another word for it. We call it dominoes because no one where I'm from knows what Gulf Coast is and has no meaning for them. But we do talk about dominoes every single day. Attack training, dominoes, action shooting. That's what we do every single pregame and every single pre-practice. Okay, attack training, one of the things that we do every single practice. I love it because I don't have to teach a new drill and we can adjust it to focus on anything that we want. So here's just the basic setup. It also gets a lot of players involved touching in a half court with only one hoop. A lot more players touching the ball than like two line layups per se. So we go on both sides of the floor. Let's just talk organization here. All right, both sides of the floor, three spots, porch, you can see porch, corner, and action spot. And right now this group of attack training is actually going high action spot, like kind of how a racker might cross half court attack training. We want to then have an attack from the action spot. So you see the ball goes up top, we have an attack from the action spot, and the porch player, after they initiate the possession, then is going to give a defensive read. Right now the ball handlers that are attacking from the action spot or hunting a nine are reading chest and shoulder. Right. So both of these defenders on both sides of the floor, they're showing chest reads right now. Chest means pass or counter. We're just passing. And so that is the read of the attacker. Then they pass out. We're getting our sevens and we just flow and rotate. It's continuous. Ball flows. We read. We get another chest read. So we're getting lots of shots up in a kind of a game like situation. So this is the basic setup of attack training. Okay, oh, there we go. Nice. We show a shoulder read as Forty here does a little skirmish or a little stunt. And so they read to go get their nine. So it's connected to nines and sevens, right? It's continuous. We have a little bit of mess. We got a little bit of chaos to kind of tie into the game. This is the basic format and organization of attack training. Mark, any follow-up questions or things you want to point out on attack training?
This popped in your head when the ball screen stuff.
So we did attack training. So we just adjusted the first thing that we did. We did three steps on our ball screen stuff. We just adjusted attack training. So all we did was, as the pass got up to the action spot here, we had the corner then follow their pass into a ball screen. And we had our defender, once they passed the ball out, went out and guarded on ball. So they worked on, when they heard screen and everyone else's job in the lines was calling out the screen, all they did was shift from their normal lock left stance to a press stance. We pressed into the right hip of the ball handler to force them to go left, and they chased over top the screen. So that was our first progression, was out of attack training, of how we're going to guard on the ball. Then the offense played it out live. If they could get a nine, they got it. If they couldn't get a nine, they kicked it out for a seven. Step two of it was then we went two on two from on a side. And so same thing, ball would get to the action spot. We would come into a ball screen, and now we worked on our hedge defender working on blitzing the ball screen. And we gave them the choice. They could blitz into a switch or they could blitz into a trap. It didn't matter. But we had to make sure that our hedge defender or the person guarding the screener was at or above the level of the screen being set, so they blitzed the ball when it was forced to go left. So step one out of attack training, make sure it goes left. If they reject the screen and go right, we've already lost. Step number two is we need to make sure that we have a presence on the ball handler when they come off the screen, and you could blitz into a trap or blitz into a switch, and it just required them to talk a little bit more. So that was progression two. We did that for probably 20 minutes. There's numerous teachings that went on out of that. Progression three, we did it out of 4-on-4 live. So every neutral catch was required for a ball screen. That was the only action that they were allowed to run. And so then the defense got to implement what they were doing out of 4-on-4 live. We did it out of flow game. So that was our progression for an hour. Attack training into 2v2 into 4v4 live.
Awesome. Love it. I've got a couple things that really resonated with me. And we're going to go into the teach better. So I'll take your game of the week and I'll give you some tips on really, or really just highlight on what you're already doing. Two frameworks to work out of, or two thought processes here. I will start with the first one that came to mind in the first iteration of attack training. You mentioned shoulder chest. You are teaching players what to look for. I would encourage all coaches to challenge themselves to train the eyes first, because what players see is going to create the read, which will create the decision for them, which ultimately leads to the skill. So I drive from the action spot in attack training. I see chest, which tells me to kick to corner. So now I've got to have the skill to stop, jump, throw that jump skip pass to the corner. So vision precedes decision, decision precedes skill. Second thing, as you went to ball screen, that I really liked is I would encourage coaches to teach reads first, technique second. So you said, we're going to pass, follow our pass with a ball screen. Defense, just make sure it goes left. That is teaching the read. Can we just get them to understand where we're forcing the ball? Can we get the ball into jail, right? And then maybe some technique stuff follows. So we're into the right hip, but how do we do that with a collapsed elbow? Because the tighter we are onto that hip, the easier it is for me to get over the screen. If I have an extended arm, well, now I'm a bigger target. I could push off. That's a foul. But if I do it with a collapsed elbow, so that would be the technique that you would add. But I would encourage you not to add the technique until your players get used to just make sure the ball goes left.
Excellent. I'm going to implement those tomorrow.
Good deal. Well, you mentioned film heavy lock left cohort next month. We have one more week of the Drive in Space cohort. It's actually going to go into October 1st. So next Tuesday, we will be on Google Meet with all of our Grow members for an hour, and we're going to do an hour-long film session of Drive in Space offense. So great opportunity for coaches to ask questions on Drive in Space, but also I'm going to go through a bunch of possessions and just tell you what action that is, what trigger caused that action, why we did what we did, or what should we have done if we made a mistake. So really, really excited about week four. If you hop in late, you get the archive. In fact, you will unlock the entire Savvy Classroom. So even if you jump in week four, you'll have, would you say like 10,000 hours of content and resources available to you for the entire month. So I would invite coaches, jump in, give us a month, and we'll help you have your best season yet. Stay savvy.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.